The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Happy week after Thanksgiving if you're here in the States. I hope everyone had a great holiday, didn't overeat, maybe even got a chance to go out for a ride. I want to talk a little bit about this year's political season, even though the presidential election is over. Now we are in the throes of nominating cabinet members. And this week, Elaine Chao was nominated for the position of Secretary of Transportation for the Trump administration. I try to get a number of people to weigh in on this nomination with me on air. None would do that. So I'll just fill in where I am able, and we'll see how it all turns out after Inauguration Day. Elaine Chao has been characterized as a longtime Washington insider. She was the Secretary of Labor under George W. Bush. There have been countless articles written since Ms. Chao's nomination, and all of them reiterate what I just said. But how much any of this will influence the relationships and intentions of those who want to see pedestrian, cycling, and public transportation programs included in any infrastructure rebuilding plans remains to be seen. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, said when asked about Mrs. Chao, and this is a direct quote, "Senate Democrats have said that if President-elect Trump is serious about a major infrastructure bill backed by real dollars, not just tax credits, and without cutting other programs like health care and education, that we are ready to work with his administration." Schumer also said in a statement, "I hope Secretary Chao shares that ambitious goal and is willing to work with Democrats to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure and create millions of good-paying jobs along the way." So that said, let's move on to this week's show. One of the basic tenets of the recent political campaign was about getting the U.S. back on track with manufacturing and jobs. Today, I'm speaking with Tony Karklins. He's the founder and CEO of HIA Velo. HIA stands for Handmade in America. He is launching a brand new manufacturing facility in Little Rock, Arkansas. Bikes will begin to roll out in the spring of 2017. And Tony's going to give us some background on his work in the bike industry and his dream of being the company that creates product and jobs here at home. After our conversation with Tony, we'll fill in a couple of current events, and then it's off to Boulder, Colorado to speak with world champion triathlete Siri Lindley. Siri, who's now retired from racing, coaches world-class athletes and tells her story of how she came to be the champion that she was in her new book, Surfacing. Siri grew up in the shadow of a great American hero as the stepdaughter of Frank Gifford. She's gay. She's a crazy good athlete, and she relates her story in a heartfelt and inspiring way. Marinda Carfrey, three-time Ironman world champion, said, quote, "Siri's story embodies the transformative power of self-belief," end quote. I'm looking forward to talking with her. So we have a great show for you this week, and we're going to head on down to Little Rock, Arkansas first to speak with Tony Karklins. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, I want to start with the question, who is Tony Karklins and how did he become involved in the bike business?
I've been in the bike business since I was 11 years old. My family moved into a neighborhood and bought a house right behind the neighborhood bike shop. So I was the kid that borrowed the wrench to change my flat, who slowly worked my way into getting a bike shop job. And I worked changing flat tires and building kids' bikes at Christmas. And worked my way up to a point when I was 16 years old. I had a friend whose father was a local banker, and he loaned me the money to buy half that business.
Wow!
I was a 16-year-old IBD owner in 1986, and I stayed an IBD until 1999, had two stores, spent about $3 million in revenue at that time, and was kind of a consistent BDS 100, top 100 retailer for those last few years.
Where was that?
Little Rock, Arkansas.
Oh, you've been there the whole time.
Yeah. My family moved up here from New Orleans in the mid-70s.
Well, how come you don't sound like you're from Little Rock, Arkansas? You sound like you're from a Yankee or something.
My father was born and raised in Latvia, and my mother was born and raised in Manhattan, and they met getting their master's degrees at Tulane. And then after they graduated, they took a job in Little Rock, and they thought it'd be a six-month job before they got back to the Northeast, and I never left.
Ha ha, right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know much about Arkansas other than, of course, the Clintons were there.
They were customers of mine all through those years. I sold Chelsea all of her kids' bikes, and I sold Bill and Hillary their bikes before they went off to Washington the first time.
That's very cool. What a great story. I love that. Well, now you've taken on the ultimate challenge. So this whole election has been about jobs and manufacturing, and now you are going to be the poster child for bikes and build carbon fiber bikes here in the U.S. with your new company, HIA Velo. Tell me about how you decided to do this.
Well, as I said earlier, I've been in the bike industry my whole life. After being an IBD, I was into import and export, and I took a 14-year job managing Orbea's business in North America. And after that, I've taken a couple of contract jobs in manufacturing. What I noticed over the last 20 years is that factory after factory was closing. When carbon fiber hit the bike industry and took all the momentum away from steel and aluminum production, pretty much most of the American and European factories closed. When I was working with Orbea in the early to mid-2000s, it was an environment full of welders, full of engineers, full of bike assemblers, full of painters. It was a full-on factory. And I really got to see firsthand what it was like when those jobs got shifted overseas. And it happened to everybody in the bike industry.
That's true.
Now we're in an environment where only the artisan makers produce their own products. I mean, you walk into damn near any bike store, and the brands that you see in those stores, they're not the manufacturers of those bikes. Okay, maybe they're the designers, and maybe they have a couple engineers on staff here or there, but they're not making those bikes. And to me, that's why I said in one of our launch videos, the industry lost its soul. It did. This is a cycling industry. There has to be passion in the production of these products. This is a recreational sport. This is a sport that is usually the user's main thing that they do outside of work and family. And I believe there's a lot of passion that was lost in the last 20 years in the production of those products. You look in there now, it's a sea of sameness, you know?
It is, yeah. I mean, I was in IBD for probably a little bit longer than you, not a lot longer, and I watched it come and go. You know, now it's NABS, which is where you'll see some of the artisan work here in, well, and we just came back from the Philly Bike Show, and there were a lot of nice handmade bikes there.
Yeah, no, I mean, in that environment, it's one of the things that really inspired me to do this.
Well, I think it's really cool.
Who doesn't want to own a Moose? You know, when you go and look at the welds on those things and you see that kind of passion, you're like, that is phenomenal. You know, for me, I wanted to make product like that more accessible. And to do it more accessible and in more modern materials, you know, we had to start this project.
Before we actually talk about the factory and how it's going to work and all of that, I want you to tell us a little bit about your team. You've got some really high rollers on your team, Doug Zell, Sam Pickman. Who's working in your factory and how did they come together to form HIA?
That was me. I spent the last year kind of putting that team together. I've flown a million miles this year and flown all kinds of people into Little Rock, explained what we're doing and trying to find, you know, the most skilled people that we possibly can that are willing to relocate and be part of building this company. And, you know, in composite manufacturing, it's really hard to find, you know, deeply skilled engineers that have production experience because all that production's overseas. So I was very fortunate to find both Sam Pittman and Chris Mertens, who had spent a lot of time working in Asia for their previous employer. And they were basically the most advanced people I could find anywhere. And I got them to join our team here mid-late March. I also brought with us from Canada their main carbon production specialist up there, a young guy whose only job his whole life has been to work in the Guru Composite Department. Worked there for 11 years. I got him a TN1 visa, and he's been down here for a couple of months now. And he's got that artisan hands-on, you know, when he puts the material in his hands, you can just tell it's in a pro's hands. He just holds it differently. It's amazing what he can do with the material. And those three people were really the foundation of our carbon development here. We've got some contractors working with us that have very deep experience as well, people that were working in other projects with Sam and Chris in the past. We brought in David Warnett from Zen Fabrication in Portland because not only do we want to do composite, we also want to do steel and alloy production. And so David right now is working on our first steel bike, which we'll introduce this year at NABS. Steel and aluminum will get us into other price ranges and other categories. And we want this company to be not just the next carbon race bicycle. We want it to be a brand that's producing in all categories and in all applicable materials.
Wow, you just answered one of my questions later on down the list here, but that's really, really cool. You know, I'm a big Steel is Real fan, and I'm really glad to hear that. Tell us a little bit about the equipment. I know you brought the Guru equipment down from Canada.
Yeah, we bought the factory in early February, and that factory had enough machinery in place for production of around 1,500 to 2,000 units a year. So we got a huge paint booth. We got three heat presses, we got the laser cutting table, we got a CNC mill, we got three or four welding stations. You know, we got basically everything that we needed to be operational. We had to buy a few more things when we got it relocated, and we definitely had some power conversion issues. I did not know how different Montreal power was to Little Rock power, but we got through that. And then we put a lot more equipment in place for carbon production that makes it as clean as possible. We've invested a lot there so that our filtration systems, our sanding stations, they're state-of-the-art clean production.
So let me ask you a little bit about the raw materials that you're going to be using, forgetting steel and aluminum for the time being, the carbon fabric and the glue and the epoxy and all of that.
It's called prepreg.
Got it.
And that's when they take the raw fibers and they label them with the resin and these big sheets and 100-pound rolls.
Where is that stuff coming from?
So our prepreg is prepreg in the United States. And we're purchasing that from suppliers that usually bring the raw fibers in from Asia, which is where, at the moment, the best fibers are coming out of Asia. And then they will take those fibers and create prepreg, usually in Southern California, Utah, or Virginia. And so we're taking supply of American prepreg.
Cool. That's really, really cool.
So that's something we're watching closely because there's rapid development on high-end fibers coming from the United States. So soon, I believe, we'll be able to have fibers that are U.S. fibers and U.S. prepreg. But right now, we have to use Asian fibers and U.S. prepreg. So we pay a little more for it. It'd be very easy for us just to take prepreg out of Asia. It'd probably save us 30% of our material costs. But, you know, one of the things that we want to do is we want this product to have a Made in America designation that is crystal clear. And so oftentimes we're presented with challenges of, hey, we could just have this part made in Asia, or we could do it here at a higher cost. And we're making the right decision every time.
You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I want to remind our listeners that we are talking with Tony Karklins from HIA Velo in Little Rock, Arkansas. And would you say that HIA is one of the first, if not the only, new bicycle manufacturing facility in the U.S. right now?
It's my belief that we're the second largest premium bicycle manufacturing facility in the United States.
Who's the first?
Well, Trek.
Oh, how soon we forget, right?
Don't forget those guys.
No, I won't.
but outside of that, I mean, in the artisan community, You know, there's some guys with more volume than us right now, but as far as the production capacity here and what we're forecasting for 2017 and what our plan is, we should be clearly the second largest in track.
Let's talk a little bit about the bikes themselves. I'm assuming you're focusing on high-performance bikes. What are we going to see for models and sizing and customization? And are these all going to be under HIA Velo's name, or are you making for other people?
There's a lot of confusion around that. I mean, HIA Velo is the manufacturing company, and so that is the entity that will be launching the Allied brand in February. So Allied will be our first and our main project that HIA Velo is the owner of. Possible in the future, HIA Velo could have some involvement in a component brand or in an MTB brand, but Allied is the brand that we're launching this year. And that brand will be launching between late January through the NABS show. It'll be kind of a consistent rollout during those months.
How many models will Allied have?
Allied's going to launch with four models, and then we will be adding new models in as quickly as our little team can get them developed.
Are they all high performance?
Well, Allied's a performance brand. So that doesn't mean we're necessarily just making race bikes, but Allied is definitely a performance brand. Our first products in the market will be a road race product and a more modern all-road or all-season type disc brake product. But both very high performance platforms, both out of composite and both out of steel. And each of the frames that we bring to market will be available in 12 sizes. So we're going to have a more advanced fit than I believe anybody else in the industry.
12 sizes is a lot of choice. Let's talk a little bit about the outlets. Are you assuming, again, using that term dangerously, that bike shops are going to be selling your brand, or are you selling direct?
We're doing both. And we've already signed up a lot of dealers because we've been kind of quietly working with people that we know, people have been following us and explaining how we see the modern world working. And we have a good list of dealers already. So when we launch, we'll launch with somewhere between 20 and 40 dealers on launch day. And then we're not really going to want more than 50 dealers in the first year because our capacity is going to be growing steadily for the first couple of years. So we want to service those dealers very well. So we're going to be available both direct sales online and through zip code protected premium IBDs.
What does that mean? Explain that to my listeners.
If you're an IBD for our products, the territory that you have is going to be designated by zip code. And if we sell online into that territory, that sale is going to run through our local partner.
Got it. It's so interesting how our business has changed since the 80s and 90s, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was an IBD, I mean, the terms exclusive territory meant something, and it seemed to go away in the last few years.
Yeah, until it didn't. That's exactly right.
And now you look into some major metro areas, and some of the big bike brands have 12 to 15 retailers in one metro area. You're like, wow, how's that happen?
Exactly. So are these going to be full bikes or are these frame sets?
They're both.
Are you making your own forks?
We are. We are making our own forks, actually going to production either late this week or early next week. And then we'll also be offering forks to the NABS community because most of those brands are using Asian source forks for these American produced frames. So we've detected an opportunity there to provide a fork brand to that clientele.
Indeed. Indeed. That's a really interesting point. I agree. I want to just talk a little bit about price points, only not necessarily what your price points are, but do you think that to get into the bicycle world right now, the barrier is particularly high?
Yes, because the way the bicycle business has turned in the last decade is people running to Asia, purchasing a lot of open mold product to quickly get to market, and they get it back to the United States. And they find that it's not really well received because it's so common. And to develop your own unique product, your own technologies, to advance materials, you have to invest a small fortune to do that. And we know that intimately well at this point.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
I know better than anybody what it costs to do it, and it's a lot. But at the end of the day, it's what the market wants. They want unique products. They want unique stories. They want people to innovate. And they also want people that are going to do that at a competitive price. There are all kinds of awesome American-produced bikes that are $15,000 bikes, but the real market is $15,000 bikes. You know, the real market is in that $2,500 to $7,500 category. That's the real premium market.
You are going to be, this is what it sounds like, direct competition to Specialized, Trek, and Giant and those guys.
Well, again, we're not to revenue yet, but we're building a big company here, as modern as possible, with extremely competitive product that is going to be customizable by the end user. We're building something that's going to scale faster.
What are you using for your fit system, just as an interest because I'm a bike fitter?
Well, I mean, we're not doing customer fits, locally. We leave that, I've worked with Retool. I've worked with the Guru system. Good friends with Dan Enfield and been through his various clinics. So I'm very comfortable with that. Sam brings a lot of geometry knowledge. So that was one of the things that we really wanted our brand to be truly appreciated by the highest service IBDs possible, people that are fit-centric.
Yeah, well, 12 sizes.
Dealers that prefer to sell the right bike instead of the bike that's stuck in the barn, that they got to get off the floor.
That's an interesting point.
Well, that's what bike shops, a lot of them have turned into, because when you take these massive pre-seasons in, you got to get them out, And it's not about the perfect fit, it's about good enough. And so we want to be in the hands of IBDs that want to do the perfect fit. And they're out there, and they're not taking big preseason orders. They're working with vendors that get them what they want. And so I think that we'll be one of the larger vendors in that environment very quickly.
Walk me through an order. John Doe comes into my store. We determine of the 12 sizes and the stem length and the bar width and whether it needs a setback seat post or not, and order the bike. It doesn't exist in my store yet. Is that correct? Is that when I get it from you?
We don't want the IBDs to hold a lot of inventory. We just need them to have enough to sell off of in their stores.
Okay, got it.
No backstock of our brand. We want our retailers to have 3 to 5 pieces on the floor that show the different materials, that show different paint, that show different technologies. Maybe one or two of them might be for immediate sale, or one or two of them might be a demo, or one of them might be the owner's bike. We want to have a presence there and be a proud small brand in the store. But we want them to order custom bikes from us every week, because we can do one of these 12 sizes. We have all kinds of different paint and graphic options, different drivetrain options, wheel upgrades, the right crank length, the right stem length, the right bar width, a couple saddle choices, so that that bike gets delivered, hopefully, exactly the way that consumer wants to ride it out of that store.
So from order to delivery, what are we talking once you're in full production?
Our goal is to be able to get an order out of here customized within 14 days.
Nice. That sounds pretty good.
It is. I mean, it's all in this one building. One of my biggest fears for next year is just how fast it's going to scale, because it seems it's going to grow a little faster than we all expected. So we've got to limit the amount of IBD that we can service for next year. And we've got to give, very good communication to the market so that we don't upset anybody with delays.
I'm going to bring up the very tiny elephant in the room, and that is Greg LeMond's new venture. He's also doing carbon fiber, but he's not doing just bikes, as I can tell. Is that correct?
I'm following it just like you. I don't know much about it. I know from a previous company I was working with that was trying to get one of those licenses. My understanding is it's a technology that's most applicable to automobile manufacturing, where there's a whole lot of material required. In the bicycle, there's barely a pound of composite required for a frame set. So in saving a significant percentage on the raw material cost of the carbon fiber, it doesn't really change the overall cost of producing that frame, because the vast majority of your cost in producing a carbon fiber frame is the labor. So we're following it. It's very interesting what they're doing over there. I think their product is still maybe 18 to 24 months away from market. I wish them the best. It sounds, what they're doing is really cool. I can't wait to see what they come out with.
What I really like is that there is thinking within the United States that people are starting to refocus home as opposed to out there. So that's really, really cool.
I've known for years that there are people working on this very thing. And I know where the other groups are and who they are. We got a kickstart. when we were able to grab that factory. And then we were also able to get Guru's intellectual property and transfer it down here and immediately start training workers. So it gave us about an 18-month head start on everybody else.
I want to say two things. Number one, congratulations. I think it's really awesome what you're doing and that it's something that I think the industry needs and will be watching. And number two, thank you for talking with me today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a happy holiday.
You too.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tony Carklins joined me from his new factory at HIA Velo in Little Rock, Arkansas. I'm very excited about this. We're going to keep watching it. We'll see where it goes. And I wish him a lot of luck. We need to take a break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Opening on November 4th and running through December 16th, the Cleveland Institute of Art presents Living Dangerously, an exhibition featuring paintings by American artist Angela Dufresne and drawings of British-born Nicola Tyson. Living Dangerously confronts the risks of walking the line between figural and abstract work. This exhibition is open to the public at CIA's Rheinberger Gallery, 11610 Euclid Avenue in University Circle. Hours and more information at cia.edu/events.
We are back after a brief break, and I do have a few news items for you this week. It is great to report on young women pros, and from Endurance Sports Wire, as you know, one of my favorite news sources each week, and from Boise, Idaho, world champion and Olympic silver medalist Chloe Dygert has re-signed for the 2017 season with 2016 Rider Biker Professional Cycling. Dygert is a native of Brownsburg, Indiana. She continues to flourish in the program, adding versatility and experience to the long-standing and dominant 2016 Ride Biker team. She says, "I'm so blessed to be able to come back and be a part of 2016 Ride Biker. It will be my fourth year with the team, and I have learned so much from the teammates and staff over these years. Kristen Armstrong will be coaching me in 2017, and I'm stoked to see where I can go working with her as coach. She was there for my first pro race, and I was there for her very last. With her focus on the coaching aspect of the team now, I am confident our team can achieve new goals. It's going to be a great year," said Dygert. 2015 and 16 seasons proved to be huge for Dygert, winning both the Junior Road and Time Trial World Championships in 2015, and then in 2016, riding to medals at the World and Olympic Games was an obvious indication of the young athlete's talent. Dygert quickly switched focus to the team pursuit for the U.S., utilizing her power and precision. With a strong engine and on-form fitness, Dygert attended her first track World Cup this season and then went on to ride to a world championship title in London in team pursuit. It's really good to hear that a woman like Chloe is doing so well, and we'll keep watching her career. It's also nice to see the Kristen Armstrong transition from racing to coaching. Longtime blogger Eldon Nelson, a.k.a. the Fat Cyclist, has begun a new chapter in his career by joining Red Kite Prayer. Eldon, along with RKP's Patrick Brady, have been podcasting together for a while. And as Patrick told us in his last conversation with us, he was hoping to get some more content providers on the site. Eldon has decided to suspend his blog and the Fattycast for now. So good luck to him and congratulations to Red Kite Prayer. Just when I thought no one was paying attention, up pops an update about Shelley Snyder. As of December 1st, here is some news finally. It comes from Chris Alvarado, who has been the one updating us since her crash. "Hi there, y'all. First, I want to give you my sincerest apologies for being lax and giving you an update. I could go on and on about how busy the holidays are, or being out of town, or being trapped under a heavy object, and two of these three excuses are true. But instead, I'll give you a quick update. Number one, our Shelley is going through some intense physical therapy. Her right side is still stronger than her left, but she is indeed moving with purpose. Number two, she can also sit upright on her therapy mat for up to 10 minutes at a time. Three, she can stand for a few minutes at a time. Four, Shelley is communicating through writing. Five, and keyboard. Six, and talking. Seven, and is back on social media. So basically, she is fighting and fighting hard to get out of the hospital and into full-time rehab. She knows how much you have all been pulling for her. If you'd like to follow Shelley's updates, you can go to GoFundMe.com Snyder.com and type in Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-I, Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, and follow what's going on with her. From the I Wish I'd Thought of That department, Folding Paper Bike Helmet wins James Dyson Design Award. Now, if you haven't seen this, it's very interesting. It's called the Eco Helmet. It's by a woman named Isis Schiffer. It comes from, as I said, the James Dyson Design Award. 28-year-old designer and bike enthusiast Isis Schiffer won the James Dyson Design Award with her Eco Helmet, a folding, recyclable, vendable helmet for bike share. Made of waterproofed paper in a unique radial honeycomb pattern, Eco Helmet empowers cyclists to ride more confidently, more safely, and more often. The New York-based industrial designer made this helmet for people who use bike-sharing schemes and might not always have a helmet with them. Schiffer wins £30,000 to improve the prototype and make it ready for production. So will it soon be available in every city? That's sort of the rhetorical question. The James Dyson Foundation aims to ignite young people's interest in engineering through free resources, the Engineering Box and workshops. Students are encouraged to think differently, experiment, and invent. Engineering will shape our future. We want to inspire the next generation of engineers, says the foundation, named after the man who gave us, among other things, the Dyson Airblade hand dryer and the filterless vacuum cleaner, British inventor and industrial designer James Dyson. So if you want to know more about the Eco Helmet, you can go to isisschiffer.com or to jamesdysonaward.org/projects/Eco Helmet. So that's really kind of a nice project. I saw it pop up and I watched a video, and it's an interesting helmet. Problem is they're all blue. So maybe sometime they'll come in other colors because, of course, it's what you wear, not who you are, right? This is a sad one. It came from my friend Larry Black, who is a bike shop owner in College Park, Maryland, and Mount Airy Cycles is one of his two shops. And our condolences go out to the friends, family, and colleagues of William Campbell. This was actually posted in the Frederick News Post this week in Frederick, Maryland. William Campbell always prayed before meals. Oscar Bernatsky Griesing, who used to work with him, said in a Facebook message, Campbell, who died after being struck by a car while bicycling last Friday, was also honest. Bernatsky Griesing said they worked together at Mount Airy Bicycle and would sometimes take walks or go out to eat. He was a very good person, always in a good mood, and willing to serve customers of the store in every way possible. Officials at R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center in Baltimore said Monday evening that Campbell had died. Campbell, 59, was struck while riding north on Maryland 27 near the Interstate 70 overpass after leaving work at Mount Airy Bicycle, said his manager, Larry Black. Campbell was about a mile away from the bike shop. Campbell was flown to Shock Trauma. Mount Airy's resident Maryland State Police troopers declined to comment, citing their ongoing investigation of Campbell's death. Campbell's brother, Wetzel Campbell, said Monday that they had been estranged for about 9 years. He did not know about his brother's bicycle crash until Sunday night when police contacted him. Campbell was known as Willie to his co-workers. He traveled the same route for years. Black said he was riding alone heading to the grocery store. He has one of the best lit bikes in the area, Black said. That is a dangerous stretch. I've ridden it for years. There's serious crisscrossing of undecided traffic. Campbell has been a member of the Gaithersburg Church of the Nazarene and was an employee of the bike shop for the last 5 years, Black said. Campbell was a popular employee at the shop. One Mount Airy resident appreciated Campbell's desire to help customers. So I hate to end on a sad note, but I do send our condolences and best wishes out to his friends and to Larry Black, my friend. We need to take a quick break, and then we're going to head on out to Boulder, Colorado to speak with world champion triathlete Siri Lindley. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. We are, as promised, heading out to Boulder, Colorado to speak with world champion triathlete Siri Lindley about her new book, Surfacing from the Depths of Self-Doubt to Winning Big and Living Fearlessly. Happy to have you on the show, Siri. Thanks for joining me this week.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm so honored to be here, and I look forward to it.
You know, I read your book, Surfacing, And it's a wonderful story. What I really loved about it was how heartfelt it is.
Well, thank you so much. That means the absolute world to me to hear you say that. It was a work in progress for a very long time. I knew that it would not be a good book unless I truly put my heart and soul and was 1,000,000% authentic in it. And that took time for me to be comfortable doing that. But this year I felt ready to put it out there. And my hope is that it can positively impact a lot of people and that people will really enjoy reading the story and hopefully gain some inspiration from it.
I don't see how anybody who reads it wouldn't just like know you right away. It is authentic. I really enjoy it. I'd like you to give us a little bit of your early background because all of that really leads up to who you are and what you've become.
Yeah. Well, do you mean athletically or personally?
No, I mean you know, how you grew up. I mean, that's how the story starts with you as a little girl and some of the things that you went through and your family went through. I mean, you lived with a very famous man for a very long time.
Yeah. I think it all started, you know, they say that you don't remember from a very young age, but it's strange how much I actually do remember from, you know, when I was about 4 years old. And I just remember those early years just being so happy. We had this tiny little house and I had my mom and my dad and my sister and we'd play Cat Stevens and hang out on the couch and play games. And it was a very, very simple life. But there was a lot of love. And to this day, I'm still someone that finds such great joy in the simple things and the little things and just, you know, feeling love and appreciation for life. Like, that's who I am. And so when my parents got divorced and my mom married Frank Gifford, who at the time was very famous, and he walked into our lives and I just felt this incredible, huge, dark cloud descending upon us. And they ended up getting married. They were married for 13 years. We obviously moved away from our tiny little house on Plow Lane and moved into this gigantic mansion with a tennis court and movie theater and all kinds of stuff. And the only problem was that my mom was now traveling all the time with him and we would be left at home alone. We had a Spanish lady that took care of us a lot of times. But as a kid and I guess kind of being a child that didn't need a lot, but just wanted to be loved. That was a really difficult time for me. And I hope I don't sound like a spoiled brat. You know, here I had everything in the world that some people would dream of having. But if that was in return for sacrificing, you know, the love and that family unit, I really didn't want it. You know, I'm so grateful for life and everything in it. And I'm actually grateful for all of that happened, and I know I'm leaving out a ton of details, and I hope people will read the book to find out more about what I'm talking about. But going through that, it really kind of forced me to grow up very quickly. It forced me to find my own strength, and I think, you know, that's something that I'm so grateful for now, because I know if I hadn't gone through that, then perhaps I wouldn't be the person that I am today.
I would think that that's true, that, you know, we are the sum of our past relationships. So one of the things that I don't want you to leave out was about you and your sister, because you are such different people. You ended up playing the same sport. So we're going to move a little bit into your athletic career. And something changed with this lacrosse sport that you got into, and you became the better athlete, evidently, or at least the more successful athlete than your sister.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's crazy because we both went through the same childhood, and my sister is the most phenomenal athlete. She's just so smart, you know, naturally smart, wouldn't have to study and could get straight A's. And I looked up to her. She was just my hero. I thought I'll never be as good as her, but she's just amazing. But for some reason, through what we went through as kids and teenagers, she turned into a lifestyle of just drinking and came up with an eating disorder that she's had for, you know, the majority of her life, and really kind of, I think there's two ways that you can let a situation affect you. You can either say, I'm not going to let this get me down, and I'm going to, despite not having the things that most people feel you need to develop properly, you know, family and a tight core around you, I'm just going to go out and do it myself and make it happen and not let this change the trajectory of my life. And I guess on the other hand, my sister, I mean, I just, part of me feels really guilty because it's like, she's so talented and so gifted in every way. And, you know, why did I get to create this amazing life that I'm so grateful for every day? And why did she end up coming into a life that's just so full of these things that are really difficult? You know, she's kind of led a bit of a tortured life. But I think when I start feeling guilty about it, it's more like, you know, I just happened to make the decision to take charge of my life regardless of who was there or who wasn't there. And she chose to kind of rebel and, in a way, I guess, be a victim to the circumstance. And we're still working on it. It's a lifetime journey with her. And right now she's been sober for 4 months. So that's the most progress we've had in a long, long time. But it definitely goes to show that you can have two people going through the exact same situation, and it's how you handle it both mentally and emotionally that will determine what effect that situation has on you.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. And the way you don't go into all that detail with, you know, what happened with your sister, but you could see she was going off the rails at one point and you sort of began to find your way. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Siri Lindley. Her new book, Surfacing, which is subtitled From the Depths of Self-Doubt to Winning Big and Living Fearlessly, is exactly that. And it's really a fun read. It's a good read. It's kind of an intense read because you begin to feel all those feelings you had. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the sport of triathlon.
I ended up working in Worcester, Massachusetts for a YMCA and had a great job there, and a friend of mine said, hey, come on and watch. I'm doing a triathlon this weekend. And I truly did not have any idea what a triathlon was. I mean, I really had no...
What year was that?
That was in 1993.
Just to put it in
so
context.
So it had been around a while, but not that long. And I just wasn't a part of that world. You know, I was into team sports. But I showed up really enthusiastically wanting to figure out, you know, what this great girl that I knew was so passionate about, and showed up at this race and was just absolutely just exhilarated by watching these people of all different ages and sizes and ability levels, and they're all out there and they're working so hard to like have their best day. And I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. And she crossed the line and I basically like barreled her over and said, oh my God, I want to do it. You need to coach me. And I knew on that day, which is so strange because I didn't know how to swim. I really didn't know how to bike. I hadn't biked since I was a little kid. And my running consisted of, you know, sprinting up and down a field. So she offered to help coach me, and that was the beginning. And it's crazy because as bad as I was, and I'm telling you, like, I know people say, oh, I stunk when I first started. Like, I was really bad, and I was embarrassingly bad. And you know, I thank my friend Lynn Oski, who is this friend that introduced me to the sport, because she, you know, wasn't embarrassed training with me, wasn't embarrassed, you know, when I had my bike with a basket and I'd play my music out of it. Like, she really wanted to help me. And I just knew for some reason that this was going to be the greatest challenge of my life, and I wanted to become proficient in the sport that I just thought was so amazing. And that became my life. Literally, I just threw myself into this dream and did everything that I could to learn about the sport and to get fit and to get strong and to make it happen. And thank God that all panned out in the end. You know, a lot of failures and a lot of embarrassments, but also, you know, I never really took those on. They just kind of inspired me to keep trying harder and finding new ways, and ultimately was able to win a world championship. So I'm so incredibly grateful. It was just an incredible journey, really.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. Your journey from watching the first little triathlon that you did to becoming a world champion, I'm telling you, it is, when you read it, it's sort of like, I can't believe she allowed herself to go through this. Like, how could she keep doing it? One of the best parts of the book was your training with a guy named Brett Sutton. I think it was in Switzerland. And it was terrifying what he did, but he had you lose weight. He trained you till you thought your heart was going to jump out of your chest and you weren't going to be able to move your arms. And the next thing you knew, he was standing there as you won a World Cup championship.
Yeah, exactly. Brett Sutton is notorious for being one of the greatest triathlon coaches in the world. And at the time when I joined his squad, I just thought, first of all, I can't even believe I'm here, you know, and it was terrifying, just the thought of working with this guy that I'd heard so many things about, you know, most importantly, that he just absolutely worked his athletes to the bone, and you survive, then you'll make it, but you'll either survive and become a champion or you'll fall to pieces. And that's kind of what I had been told, but I went out there, and his greatest strength is his ability to analyze the mental goings-on of each athlete that he has. And when I went to him in the year 2000, I had gotten myself to a pretty high level, coming in top 10 in World Cup races and a lot of fourth places. But obviously there was a part of me that thought, I'm just never going to be good enough to get on the podium or to win a big race. And I think he saw that as soon as I arrived, and his way of getting me to perform at a whole new level, I don't think it had anything to do with the physical work. I mean, obviously a little bit, but more importantly, what he did is just gave me the most horrific training sessions all day, every day from the day that I got there. And these, you know, he'd tell me what we were about to do, and I would think, there's no way I'm going to survive this, you know, my first day. And I'm going to leave a lot of the great stories for you to read the book, but you know, just more than I'd ever done probably in a week, I would be doing in one day. And I would call home and I'd just be crying over the phone and say, I don't know if I'm going to survive. Like, I might die. I might not make it home. And that's how hard it felt. But it was brilliant, because every day I would succeed. Every day I would accomplish the task that he had handed me. And every day I would actually do a decent job. And so every day I was getting a little bit more confident. Every day I was realizing a little bit more that I had a lot more strength than I thought I did. And what ultimately ended up happening is that I went for my first race about a month and a half after I had arrived in Switzerland, and I came in second, so my first podium in Hungary. And then a week later, I won my first World Cup race, and it was just an absolute dream come true. But what he did is presented me with things that I thought were impossible, and provided me with the inspiration, the motivation, whether it was fear or just, you know, not wanting to fail amidst all these other great athletes. And in accomplishing those tasks every day, I was achieving something I thought was impossible every day. It really built up the confidence that I so desperately needed to take that next step to actually win a race.
So let me once again remind our listeners, we're speaking with Siri Lindley. She's in Boulder, Colorado. She's written a book called Surfacing from the Depths of Self-Doubt to Winning Big and Living Fearlessly, which she has, and she does, and she is. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. So you actually have now retired, and you are now coaching. So, and you're coaching world-class athletes. So obviously you've taken something from all of these different things you've done, and you've started this coaching business. How do you think today's triathlete, you know, I can relate to it going all the way back to the mid-80s when I produced a half Ironman here in Northeast Ohio, and I can remember a lot about it. But how do you think the sport has changed since you saw your very first race and then since you retired from the sport?
I think it's changed in amazing ways. I mean, it's definitely a sport that people respect, and it seems that it has this whole kind of energy to it, you know, especially Ironman. It's like this epic sport that people dream of being able to achieve. And there's a lot more funding, and there's the races are bigger, and the races are better run, and the competition gets higher and higher and higher. I mean, when you look at how these races are being raced, the way that people used to race like an Olympic distance triathlon, they're now basically racing at that same intensity for an Ironman. And that's how high the level has become. I think one thing, and I don't know why this is coming into my mind, but one thing that I feel has changed a lot is that in all the national development programs, you know, they're looking for the top swimmers, and they're looking for the top runners for
to kind of build them up and train them so that one day they can make it to the Olympics for their respective countries. And I think to myself, you know, in my day, if there was a program in place like that that was only looking for athletes that could swim and run, I would have never been given an opportunity to even have a chance. And so I'm so grateful that it wasn't like that in my day, because I would have definitely kind of slipped through the fingers of the people selecting and probably would have never become a world champion. So the way that things are now, I continue to coach the way I believe. And that's what I really feel, that, you know, anything is possible for anyone if they want it bad enough and if they're willing to do all the work necessary to make it happen, no matter how hard or how long that's going to take. So I will never turn away from an athlete because they're not a good swimmer, turn away from an athlete because they don't have a background in swim, bike, run. If I see that potential and I see that fire, I'll take on that athlete. And I find that the incredible challenge of it is kind of harnessing the triathlete within them and bringing out the best in them. And I guess I've had a lot of people, you know, I have one world champion athlete that won Ironman, that at the time when I took her on, there were about three other coaches that said, oh, don't bother. You know, you're not going to be able to do anything with her. And if I had, you know, listened to them and said, okay, I'm not going to bother with this person, I wouldn't have that world championship on my coaching resume. And this amazing athlete wouldn't have it on hers either. So I think that's how it's changed, if that all makes sense. But
yeah,
I think
sure.
Both in performance and also in bringing up athletes in the sport.
I think that's a really interesting perspective. I'm not hearing you say they're looking for cyclists. I'm hearing you say they're looking for swimmers and runners. Is cycling not considered the place where you can make up time? I always felt that people will only swim so fast and run so fast and transition so fast, but that you can make up time on a bike.
Well, we are on the same page. That's how I feel too. Totally. And yeah, and I guess for what I'm talking about is kind of like the Olympic selection. So for like the World Cup racing, which is draft legal racing. And to be honest, I mean, really the emphasis is they figure if they have someone who can already swim and already bike, or already swim and already run, that the bike will be the easiest to develop. And I kind of disagree with that because I think, yeah, so I have a very different mind to the federations in our sport, but I strongly disagree. And especially for what I coach, for the most part, I coach longer distances like half Ironman and Ironman. I mean, like you're saying, the cycling aspect is so crucially important. And the better a cyclist you are, the better runner. So that's my bike right at those distances. That's going to be a problem. But again, anybody that has that drive and that desire and that willingness to do what it takes to build up their strength and their fitness and their mental fortitude, I believe that they can make it. But yeah, it's crazy to me. And that was when I was racing in the World Cup draft legal racing. I always just wanted to just race as hard as I could from start to finish, you know, just kill myself on the swim, kill myself on the bike, kill myself on the run, and hope I finish as close to the top as I can. But nowadays it's a much more strategic race. You have to come out in that front pack, and then they, you know, there's some strategy and they're biking hard. But as far as recruitment, yeah, they're just looking for swimmers and runners. But I'm looking for cyclists, just so you know.
Oh, good. So that our listeners know that, too. Do you have any regrets after you retired that you didn't do all you wanted to do? I hate regrets. I hate that idea.
Yeah, I hate regrets. No, I have zero regrets. I honestly could have retired in 2001 after winning the world championship, because I think I found what I was looking for, and that was myself. And kind of self-belief and all of that. But I didn't want to be a fluke, and I didn't want people to say, oh, well, that was just 1 year, you know, whatever.
Sure.
So I committed to trying to put together as good a season as possible another year and hopefully finish with the number one ranking in the world for a second year. And I was able to do that. And literally after the last race, I was just so ready to move on and start giving back, you know, to the sport. And I just had this intense desire to share how I found a way with other people, and the joy in watching them achieve their dreams is even more incredible than achieving your own. So I really feel like this is what I'm truly destined to be and what I'm meant to be doing. But obviously my time as an athlete has allowed me to be the coach that I am today.
We're going to wrap it up, but I have just a few more questions for you. One is, can you briefly tell us what the word surfacing, why you use that as the title of your book?
I feel as though from early on in my life, I felt really overwhelmed with fear and anxiety, and I was insecure, and I just felt like life was really, really kind of heavy and dark. And then I kind of just got on this quest for wanting to find myself and find my strength and find a way and try to find happiness and, even more importantly, peace within myself. And to me, when I think about where I was and where I wanted to be, it really felt like I was coming from down deep and trying to find my way to the top. And I feel so grateful that I was able to find a way, you know, through the hardest times, the greatest gifts came. But surfacing, and I think also coming into who I am and living authentically and being who I am without shame and without holding back and without hiding any part of me. It's just everything coming to the surface and bringing light and peace and happiness and just kind of a feeling of celebrating the life that I can now live to the fullest because I'm just fully being me.
Awesome. That was a great description. I love it. All right. Here come the silly questions. What's your favorite food?
Thai food. I just had some last night. It was amazing.
Oh, thank you for not saying pizza. Do you have any pets? Now, I know you grew up with a dog. Her name was Whoopi, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, my house is full of pets. My partner and I, we have 3 rescue dogs, 1 rescue cat, and 2 rescue horses. So we are rescuing animals and providing them a happy home, knowing how much love they give us is definitely one of our major goals in life. So, yes, we love animals.
Okay. And what is your favorite music to listen to?
Oh, boy. I love, like, Jack Johnson. I love, oh, my God, I love everything. I have a different style of music for different moods. Love dancing music, you know, Pitbull, and all kinds of stuff. But I also can get into a mellow mood where I just want to listen to like spa music, and that kind of brings me calm.
So here's the last one. Where can people get a copy of Surfacing?
They can either order off of Amazon.com or go to Barnes & Noble or order off of VeloPress or come right to my website, which is Siri-Lindley.com, and I can sign a copy and send it out to them. So would absolutely love for people to check it out and hopefully they'll enjoy it.
Well, I certainly enjoyed it and I thank you for writing it and I thank you for talking with me today. It's been a delightful conversation. I hope you and Rebecca have a wonderful holiday. And if I ever get to Boulder, I'll look you up.
I would love that. And thank you so much, Diane. It really is an honor to be on your show.
Thanks.
And I wish you a happy holiday as well. You're awesome.
Thanks. Take care of yourself.
Thanks so much. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Siri Lindley joined me from her home in Boulder, Colorado. What a great conversation. The book, again, is Surfacing, From the Depths of Self-Doubt to Winning Big and Living Fearlessly. It's an excellent hardbound book. It would make a very nice gift if you are looking for one for your, you know what? You don't even have to be just a triathlete. Just anybody would really enjoy her story. It's a great story. Thank you for listening to the show this week. I'd also like to thank Tony Kirklands for his conversation. I hope you're having a great week. If it's nice where you are, you know what you're supposed to do. Go for a ride. Talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.